Six Music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, the show where we speak to some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around about the significant first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. In 1965, the UK press claimed that the Byrds were America's answer to the Beatles, something that's probably a bit inaccurate, but the LA five-piece did change popular music, and one of the people that instigated that change from the band was Roger McGuinn. His voice, his songwriting, and his 12-string Rickenbacker guitar. And Roger is my guest this week on The First Time.
Still you say you're gonna stay if you don't wanna be all mine.
Born in Illinois, Roger absorbed early rock and roll and mixed it with American folk music, then melded it with Beatles beats and harmonies to create a new sound, a sound that led the Byrds to huge international success with songs like 8 Miles High and their versions of Turn, Turn, Turn and Mr. Tambourine Man. Here Roger talks about the idea that, as well as inventing folk rock, he also helped create country rock, as the Byrds enlisted Gram Parsons for their seminal 1968 album Sweetheart of the Rodeo. He also chats about his time collaborating with Bob Dylan, the eventual dissolution of the Byrds, and his ongoing passion for bringing traditional folk songs back into public consciousness. He also brought his guitar. But I started by asking Roger, as I do with all my guests on The First Time, when was he first aware of music?
The very first time I was aware of music, I think, was maybe 3 years old, and I heard clang, clang, clang goes the trolley, whatever.
Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heartstrings. From the moment I saw him, I fell.
That was in the 40s, and I forget where I was or anything.
Was it a very musical household?
Not really. My parents sang in the shower. My mother had studied piano but didn't really play piano. However, her parents were avid writers and players of music. My grandmother had concert appearances at the Art Institute, but it was amateur stuff. You know, it wasn't professional. But she was a musician.
Was there a record player in the house that would get used with great ceremony?
Well, in my grandmother's house, they had a record player that not only played records but recorded records. So it was one of those early disc recording machines, and that was quite exotic for the time.
What sort of thing can you remember being played?
What comes to mind are Christmas carols, standing around the piano and singing, "Oh, come all ye faithful," and "Joy to the World." When my grandmother played, she played in a style that was kind of clunk, 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 clunk. That's how it seemed to me at the time.
What about the first piece of vinyl that was yours, the first record that you owned? Always a massive deal. Even if it's an embarrassing record, it always makes an impact on people.
I think probably Heartbreak Hotel. I went out and bought the single, the RCA single, Elvis Presley. That was the first record that got me interested in playing music. Prior to that, I'd listen to music and I'd go to sock hops, dances, and listen to music, but I didn't want to play music. But Elvis got me really fired up about playing music.
Because people talk about Heartbreak Hotel being, it's almost impossible for people after that generation to understand the impact of that single. Did it really feel like a kind of a bolt from the blue?
Well, yeah, it was. I'd never heard proper blues, even though I'd grown up in Chicago, but I was on the north side and I didn't have transportation. I walked around and there was not a lot of blues going on in the north side. It was all on the south side. So when I heard Elvis, he was combining blues and country music, and it was a synthesis that was just, it grabbed me. It really grabbed me.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel, where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be just so lonely, baby. I'll be just so lonely, I'll be so lonely, I could die. Keep flowing, the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on the street, they'll never look back and think you're so, think you're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely, well, they're so lonely, and they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down Lonely Street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be. You're so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die.
In terms of seeing music live, you mentioned kind of sock hops, but did you go and start seeing little groups and little performances?
No, I really didn't. I didn't go to concerts until later on when I was in high school. And then I started going, I got into folk music, and I'd go to the Orchestra Hall in Chicago and watch the Weavers and later Pete Seeger and go to classical concerts.
What was the first folk record that you fell in love with then? What was the first piece of music you can remember thinking, I've discovered this, this resonates with me?
Well, it wasn't really traditional folk so much as a sort of a souped-up version of folk. Bob Gibson came to my high school when I was 15 and played, let's see. Well, 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 who's that a-calling? Well, 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 hold my hand. Well, 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 night is a-falling, spirit is a-moving all over this land.
I told Noah, build him an ark, build it out of a hickory bark. Rain started falling, water started to climb. God set a fire, not a flood next time.
Well, 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 falling. The spirit is a moving all over this land. Well, well, well.
I can see why that would make an impression on somebody. Yeah, it's a pretty powerful piece of music.
It was almost rock and roll,
yeah,
what he was doing. It had some soul to it. And it wasn't like the traditional this land is your land, you know, kind
yeah
of thing.
When we spoke before, we started to talk about your first experience of British music, and you mentioned skiffle. We always associate skiffle being hugely influential in the UK, but not so much in America, I guess. Did it have a big impact on you then?
There was a time when skiffle was popular in America. I mean, Lonnie Donegan got a couple of hits in the top 10.
Well, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Well, the Cumberland Gap ain't nowhere. Cumberland Gap, ain't nowhere 15 miles from Middlesbrough. Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Well, I've got a gal 6 feet tall, sleeps in the kitchen with her feet in the hall. Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Well, two old ladies sitting in the sand, each one wishing that the other was a man. Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. Cumberland Gap, Cumberland Gap, 15 miles on the Cumberland Gap. I'm a little daddy on the guitar.
I don't think it lasted as long as it did in the UK. I think it was probably just before or after the Calypso craze. And then the Calypso craze moved into the kind of commercialized folk music from the Kingston Trio, who had named themselves that because of Calypso, you know, Kingston, Jamaica.
Yeah.
So they were like a Calypso group, and then they morphed into more a broader folk range.
That era in American folk, kind of formative years, it's almost tainted with this sort of golden memory of like such a creative time and so many people coming up with new ideas. Was it actually like that, or was it maybe a bit more of a struggle than people imagined?
No, it was really like that. It was a very intense creative period, I'd say from 1950 to 1965, around there, 67, 69. Mm. There was a lot of intense creativity going on. And Elvis had started something, and then the Beatles came, and they were a new way of a paradigm shift to, over into doing it yourself, writing your own music, playing your own band tracks, and being a really good band that had worked hard and paid their dues for many years in the Reeper Bond, you know. That.
Yeah, because you did quite a bit of session work early on, didn't you?
I did. In New York, I was a studio musician as well as a writer at the Brill Building.
What was the first big session when you sort of found yourself in the presence of, like, okay, this is serious?
It wasn't really a big session at the time. It was Paul Simon. He hired me to play 12-string on Sounds of Silence demo that he took up to Columbia Records, and that they made the record after that. And then they electrified it after the Birds went out with electric folk. So at the time, I didn't think anything of it. It was for a group called Tom and Cherry.
Yeah.
Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs that voices never share. No one did. The sound of silence. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might lead you. But my words. Sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispering sounds of silence.
In the back of your mind, was it always, this is wonderful, I'm enjoying it, I'm obviously honing my skills, but there's a group here in my mind I can see doing this?
Well, I had been an accompanist and a studio man, so I worked with the Limelighters and the Chad Mitchell Trio and Bobby Darin, and so I was kind of used to being on the side, and I wasn't really thinking of being in a group until the Beatles came out. And when the Beatles came out, they just really floored me. I had to learn I learned all the Beatles songs from Meet the Beatles, and I would mix them in with my folk songs that I'd souped up with a Beatle beat in the coffee houses. And I remember walking on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, and two club owners were on the other side of the street, and I overheard them point at me and say, "We need four of him."
Really?
And at that point, I went, I'm on to something. I think I should get a group together. But I didn't really pursue that actively, but it was in the back of my head.
What's the Beatles song that we should play at this
juncture?
I Want
to Hold Your Hand.
Just straight out, that's the one.
That's what the first two I heard were She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand. And that's where I heard the folk music chord changes. They were going. Well, there are a million folk songs that have that. You know, an earthly nori sits and sings, and I, she sings, ba-li-li-wi. Million folk songs that have that interval, which obviously the Beatles had picked up, maybe from being in Liverpool, or maybe from their experience as a quarryman doing kind of pseudo, you know, folk music or skiffle, which is souped-up folk music.
Remember the first Birds rehearsals? Can you remember kind of thinking, this is working, this has a...
I do. I remember them vividly, and I remember thinking, this is not working. We had Michael Clark, who had never played the drums before, and his initial drum kit was cardboard boxes. So, and then we had Chris Hillman, who was an excellent musician but had not played the bass before. So we had kind of a fledgling band and had never worked as a band in public. And Gene Clark, David Crosby, and I had never been in a band aside from my working with Bobby Darin. And we had kind of a combo with that, with bass and drums and so on. But I'd never worked in a rock band. So it was really not happening. And I remember Jim Dixon, our manager, hired a guy from Las Vegas to teach us dance steps. Like the Jackson 5.
I'm just trying to imagine what that would look like.
Yeah. You can see us in gold lamé jackets doing these kicks, you know, all together in unison. And that wasn't working. And the guy threw his hands up. He walked out of the studio. He said, I quit. You guys don't have what it takes to make it in show business. And he went back to Las Vegas. And we started getting good at that point. We went, oh, yeah. We'll show him, you know, we'll show everybody. We're going to get good. And that's when it started to gel. We started to be a cohesive unit. Mm. It started to sound good. And we all looked at each other like, wow, this is working. But it was months into it. It wasn't right away.
I have to ask you about Miss Tambourine Man. It's your first number one, 1965, a song that not just kind of dominated radio, but really struck a nerve and an emotion with people in the way that very few songs do. Must be lovely to be involved with that song. But do you remember it first coming out and feeling that wave of like, here it comes. Here comes recognition. Here comes popularity.
Yes, it was slow in coming, though. We recorded the song in January of 1965, and Columbia Records was very shy about releasing it. They didn't have any rock acts on their label. They had Doris Day, Steve Lawrence, and Edie Gourmet, and a lot of classical and show tunes, but they didn't have rock. So I think they were a little bit frightened of rock and roll, but they saw Capitol Records and RCA making money on it, so they thought they ought to get into it. But the deal was for one single, and if we got a hit with Mr. Tambourine Man, we could go back into the studio and record the rest of the album. If we didn't, we were back on the street, had to look for another deal. So Jim Dixon had heard a demo of Mr. Tambourine Man, and he'd overheard a couple of record producers in Hollywood talking about Bob Dylan, saying, "Oh, it's a shame Bob can't use that great new song he just wrote because somebody was singing out a tune on it." And that was Ramblin' Jack Elliott. And the tune was like this. "Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there's no place I'm going to.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle
jangle morning, I'll come following you." And David Crosby said, "I don't like it, man." he didn't like the vocal, and he didn't like the 2/4 time, because rock and roll was all 4/4.
Mm-hmm.
So I souped it up with a Beatle beat, and it came out with a beat like that. And I put this little, I've been playing around with. I thought, what if you put something like that on the front for an intro? Yeah, it's not a direct steal from Bach, but it was inspired by Bach.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and that was Mr. Tambourine Man, the classic version of Bob Dylan's song by The Byrds, featuring the vocals and distinctive guitar work of my guest this week, Roger McGuinn.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Listen.
you're a little insane. The money that came and the public acclaim. Don't forget what you are, you're a rock and roll star.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is one of the architects of folk rock, psychedelic rock, and country rock from The Byrds. It's Roger McGuinn. And that song you just heard was The Byrds, So You Wanna Be a Rock and Roll Star, by Roger and Chris Hillman from 1967. Apparently something of a critique on the manufactured pop band The Monkees, featuring, of course, Roger's trademark guitar sound. When did you first get the sound that you wanted out of the Rickenbacker 12-string? Because it's an instrument that's synonymous with you, it's an instrument that's synonymous with not just The Byrds, but all your work, and also a certain time. And it's not just a conventional sound on those records. It doesn't sound just like someone's plugged it into an app and recorded it. It's a very specific tone that you have when you play.
What happened was, Ray Gerhart was the engineer at Columbia Records, and he was old school, probably in his 50s at the time, and he didn't want to break the meters on the board.
Right.
So he put two compressors in series on the Rickenbacker, which gave it a long sustain, and then they tweaked the EQ to kind of fit it so it wouldn't interfere with any of the other instruments. And then my picking technique, I used a banjo roll that I'd learned from Earl Scruggs, more of a arpeggios. So the combination of those three things gave it a unique sound.
You've spoken a lot about 8 Miles High being misinterpreted by people. Can you remember when it came out and thinking, no, it's not about that. It's supposed to be echoing a jazz thing rather than actually trying to, you know, be necessarily drug associated or psychedelic in that way.
Yeah, I remember.
Must be
that.
Quite frustrating.
I remember that. Well, first of all, we took it to a DJ in New York, and she listened to it and said, "Well, where's the single?" So she didn't get it, and then they labeled it psychedelic because it was kind of unusual. I ran into Larry Coryell, the jazz guitar player, some years ago, and he told me that when he heard it, he was really excited, and he went running down to this, you know, jazz club, and he played it for his friends, and they all went, wow, you know, this is great, this is jazz, and they got it. But I think jazz was such a niche market that not many people were able to identify it as jazz.
Oh, so they didn't have the reference points in their own musical knowledge.
Know what it was. And then psychedelia, you know, Timothy Leary was out saying, turn on and drop out and all that. The psychedelic movement was coming up, and the song had some interesting changes in it, a lot of fast things going on that were kind of kaleidoscopic, so you could identify it in that way. And then the Gavin Report came out and said it was a drug song and cautioned radio stations to stop playing it, which they promptly did.
And really? I didn't know that.
That was the end of that, yeah. I think it got up into the top 20, but that was the end of it. Over the years, 8 Miles High has morphed from the kind of psychedelic version with it, John Coltrane licks, into something a little more, it's got more guitar stuff in it. Got a little Andre Segovia thrown in, as well as the Coltrane and Ravi Shankar. Thank you.
is
Birds have had, I don't know if fractious is the right word, a kind of evolving lineup and a changing lineup. What do you think that was down to? I mean, was that just evolving as people and musicians and that pull and thrust of creativity and also the attention and the fame?
Well, it's kind of if you put something that was loosely constructed into a wind tunnel and bits and pieces start blowing off. That's the way it was with the Birds.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
When did you first meet Graham Parsons? Because that's obviously a lovely, it's a beautiful record.
Yeah, Chris Hillman met Graham in a bank in Beverly Hills. I guess he was getting his endowment, you know, his check. I remember being up on Mulholland in L.A. And here comes Graham in a brand new Mercedes Roadster. And I said, oh, wow, where'd you get that? You know, I just bought it. I said, okay. I didn't know he was an heir to the Snively Orange fortune from Florida. So Chris found him. He brought him over, and we were looking for somebody to replace David Crosby. And I was still in the 8 miles high mode with him. I wanted to continue with that. And I asked Graham if he could play some McCoy Tyner-style piano. And he sat down and played a little Floyd Kramer-style piano, and it was good enough. I said, okay, well, this guy's got talent. We can work with him. And I had no idea he was really like George Jones in a sequin suit. You know, he evolved into this country giant in front of us. And we had dabbled in country. We did a couple of things. But Graham was totally in love with country music, and it was infectious. He got us all into it. I remember going to the Nudie Rodeo Tailor in the San Fernando Valley and getting cowboy boots and cowboy hat. And I bought a Cadillac Eldorado. But I didn't get the bullhorns on it like Nudie had. He had a Cadillac Eldorado with silver dollars glued to the side of the whole car and a bullhorn on the hood ornament.
Amazing.
A huge one. I mean, it was, you know, 4 feet wide. We didn't go that far.
They said that I desert you.
Went to Nashville and recorded, and it was a great experience recording in Nashville with Lloyd Green and Roy Husky. It was great. They were wonderful, like Nashville studio cats, you know, they're just the best. It was like the Wrecking Crew in Nashville. And that was very cool to record with them, and they were very nice. And I ran into somebody recently who told me that Lloyd Green had passed away a couple of years ago, but they told me they were talking to Lloyd Green and how that impressed him when the Byrds worked with him, because we're so casual. I guess we were, you know, smoking pot in the studio or drinking wine or something. And nobody in Nashville did anything like that. They were all very strict and straight-laced and so on. So he enjoyed that experience. He said it was kind of a mind-expanding experience for him.
Because you played the Grand Ole Opry, didn't you? Which is a gig that's kind of sort of gone into legendary status because you were the first kind of conventional rock and roll band to play there. And whether the country establishment was happy about that or not, that's the legend around the story. I don't know if that's true or not.
The legend is correct. it was like that. I really don't know the back story of how we got on the Opry. I would think it was probably Columbia Records used some kind of pull to get us on there, but we were not welcome by the Nashville establishment, and the audience was very cold. It was, I don't think they booed us, but it was just polite applause, you know.
God.
And they normally, they cheer after every instrumental break for anybody that they know on the Opry. So it was quite different from the normal Opry reception. And then Graham kind of messed it up. We were supposed to do Sing Me Back Home, but Graham walked up to the microphone and said, you know, my grandma's always listened to the Grand Ole Opry, and so I'd like to do a song I wrote for her. And he went into Hickory Wind, and it went over time. You know, it's a commercial program. They timed it out with a stopwatch at the rehearsal, and we were totally violating their whole thing, so we weren't invited back.
In South Carolina, there are many tall pines. I remember the oak tree that we used to climb.
What was the first point when you thought, I've gone as far as I can with the Byrds? That's a world I'm done with, and now I have other things to say away from that name.
Well, it was in 73, after we had reunited for the David Geffen Asylum Byrds reunion record. And that didn't really come off the way we had hoped it would. It wasn't cohesive. Everybody was coming from different places. We weren't hanging out together. We weren't writing together as we had been. And I'd made a deal with David Crosby that I wouldn't go on the road with any Byrds other than the original ones after that. And it seemed like a fair deal to me. And we had planned on going on the road as the original Byrds if the album had been a success, but it wasn't. So it looked like it was just time to fold it up and go do something else.
So this is obviously about first. And I was going to talk about your first film soundtrack work, which was Easy Rider, but then I remembered that you feature on probably my favourite film soundtrack of all time, which is Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which is a wonderful film and a glorious soundtrack, and you work with Bob Dylan on that. Can you remember first getting the call to go and work on the project? Because Sam Peckinpah, a particularly difficult director, and Bob Dylan, a very singular artist.
Yeah.
Interesting combination.
Well, Bob and I were living in Malibu at the time, and he would come over to my house a lot, and we'd hang out. And so we were just, you know, hanging out a lot, and the gig came up. He'd been down in Mexico, and he was in the movie, and then he came back, and it was time to record the soundtrack, and he just said, come on down. And I remember driving him down there and going to the studio and going in with my banjo and 12-string and playing all these tracks. Played Knocking on Heaven's Door and some other stuff. And all the in film, it's all these little snippets, you know, like 30 seconds here and so on. So we did a lot of those. And I did something called Turkey Chase. Or something.
Turkey Chase, yeah.
With a banjo.
That's a crazy banjo piece.
So it was a lot of fun, but Bob and I were just hanging out at the time. It was right before the Rolling Thunder Review, and he was over at my house, and I had a basketball hoop in the backyard over the garage, and he saw it and asked if I had a basketball, and I did not. So I went out the next day to a sporting goods store and bought one, and I called his house, and Sarah answered, and I said, tell Bob I bought a basketball. And she said, oh, he'll be thrilled. I said, really? Well, after that, he came over. And we were shooting baskets, and I'm not good at basketball, but he was pretty good. And we got to talking, and he said, I want to do something different. And knowing Bob, anything could go, you know. I said, what do you mean? He said, I want to do something like a circus. I said, okay. And then he didn't say much more about it after that. We went back to shooting baskets. And a couple of months later, I was on the road, and I had a band and had booked quite a few dates, but there was some time off. I went to the Village, which I like to do because it was kind of old home, and I went down to the Bitter End, and I walked in the back room, and Jacques Levy and Bob Dylan were sitting at a table with a couple of brandies, and they saw me walk in, and they stood up, and the brandies went flying like an old Western movie, and they said, Roger, we were just talking about you. We're putting this tour together, and we'd like you to go out on it. And I said, oh, man, I got all these dates booked with my band. I don't think I can. But the next day, Larry Sloman, who was a writer at Rolling Stone at the time, also the nickname Ratso, he was Ratso, he called me up and said, do you remember last night you turned down Bob Dylan for a tour? I said, yeah, you know, I got all these dates booked with my band. I don't know if I can do it. He said, oh, man, you got to do it. You got to do it. So I called up my agent and said, you know, can we move these dates, postpone them? And he did. And so I had the next like 3 months open, and I signed up for the Rolling Thunder Review. And it was incredible. It was a circus. It was great.
Mama wiped the blood off of my face. I can't see through it anymore. I need someone to talk to, and I knew going down from God's distant shore. I can hear him calling for my soul. Feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
don't know how comfortable you are with these titles, but, you know, creator of folk rock, creator of psychedelic rock, creator of country rock. Being a part in any one of those would be nice, but to have a hand in all of them.
Well, I think it's a lot of hyperbole, but it's nice, and I really don't concentrate on it. I just keep doing what I do.
In 95, you started The Folk Den, which is the website and kind of online resource where you take folk music that you love and you post it online for people to listen to. And it's kind of grown and grown and grown and become this kind of huge project that spans many years and many different artists now.
Yes, it'll be 20 years next year, and over 220 free downloads, sponsored by the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill as a public service. And the idea is to keep the traditional side of folk music alive. And I do British songs, I do American and Australian songs, mostly English. I'm not really good with languages. I don't want to mess them up with it in mispronunciation, so I don't try that. But I love folk music, and I noticed in 95 an absence of the traditional side of folk music, especially in the U.S., not so much in the U.K., because there are pockets of folk lovers here. Mm. In the U.S., the folk singers had all become singer-songwriters in the Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan sort of trend, and they weren't doing the traditional part of folk music. So I thought, what's going to happen when Odetta dies or Pete Seeger dies? Nobody's going to hold up that end of it, so I thought I'd do my part.
What was the first one that you chose? Can you remember?
Yeah, it's, let's see. I ride an old paint, I lead an old band, I'm going to Montana for to throw the Julianne. They feed in the coulees, they water in the trough, their tails are all red and their backs are all dry. Ride around, little pony, ride around snow.
Six Music.
Oh!
Six Music.
Stevens.